26, 2007. We're going to work through the agenda with the first two bills, which were carried over from Friday's hearings, which were not completed first in the order in which they appear here. Then we're going to go to the public hearing on House Bill 2822, and then go back to do the work sessions on 2507, 2385, and 2536. So I'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2858. Council Stanford, could you remind us what this bill is about?
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2858 relates to the affirmative defense of guilty except for insanity. Present ORS 161.295 allows a defendant to plead the affirmative defense of guilty except for insanity if the person was unable to appreciate the criminality of conduct or to conform his or her conduct to the law due to mental disease or defect. ORS 161.309 discusses the procedural requirements for a defendant to utilize the insanity defense. Presently, a defendant must give written notice of his intent to use the defense at the time he pleads not guilty, or at a later time if the court consents. A defendant who fails to file such written notice may not introduce evidence to establish an insanity defense, that is, unless the court finds just cause to allow the defendant to do so at a future time. House Bill 2858 amends ORS 161.309 to require a defendant who wishes to assert an insanity defense to submit to the court, prior to trial, an evaluation by a certified psychiatrist or psychologist. Failure to submit such a report precludes the defendant from introducing evidence of insanity at trial, unless the court permits such evidence to be introduced where the defendant shows just cause for the failure to submit the report.
Okay, you may recall, committee, that we had heard from Dr. Bloom on Friday at kind of a fairly brief presentation at the end of the time we had available. I'd like to now go to the next witness signed up, Michael Morris from DHS.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Mike Morris, and I'm the Mental Health Policy Manager for Addictions and Mental Health Division, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 2858, and our division is supportive of the concepts in this bill, and we understand that there is a group that is working on amendments to correct some of the issues that have arisen in regards to the bill, and we will work actively with that group. I believe they are actually having their meeting tomorrow to work out those amendments. We do have to take a neutral stance on the bill, only for the sense that there is a fiscal impact on our division, which is not in the governor's recommended budget. We would have to have a half-time 0.5 FTE to organize the certification process, to track the individuals who are certified, track the renewals of those certifications, and also organize and conduct the training that would be required for certification. So it's only for that reason that we are taking a neutral stance. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Morris? Mr. Morris, just kind of get us oriented what's proceeding. Do you have a sense about what the amendments do? That is, what direction the people who are working on amendments are proceeding on?
I only know of at least one of the issues. This one is to clarify in what situations that you would need a certified person to conduct the evaluation, and then also to clarify who is responsible for the cost of that evaluation. Those are issues that other people have raised, and so those are only what I know secondhand.
There are no further questions then, Mr. Morris. Thank you for coming in, and we'll look forward to getting seeing what amendments come forward. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2858. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3163. Council Stanford, remind us about this bill.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 3163 relates to municipal courts and driving under the influence of intoxicant trials, or DUI trials. ORS 221.336 allows any city in Oregon to establish a municipal court by charter or ordinance. ORS 221.339 gives municipal courts concurrent jurisdiction with circuit courts over misdemeanors and in certain violations. A municipal court has no jurisdiction over felonies. House Bill 3163 amends ORS 221.339 by requiring that a municipal court become a, quote, court of record, close quote, before it can exercise jurisdiction over duties, which are typically misdemeanors. This procedure to become a court of record is covered under ORS 221.342. Essentially, there are two requirements for becoming a court of record. First, have a court reporter or audio recording service available for the courtroom to make a record. And then second, ensure that the judge is a member of the Oregon State Bar. There is a dash one amendment to 3163 that would specify that this law would apply to cities with populations less than 25,000.
Thank you, Council. Let's hear from Ann Pratt on behalf of Cranbrook and Schneider.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. I'm Ann Pratt. I'm here from Crime Victims United. I'm also a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. In 1998, when my son was killed by a drunk driver, I became involved in the legislative process because I didn't want any mother, father, brother, sister, or child to go through the agony of losing a family member to a drunk driver. I also recognized that the offender appeared to have far more rights and that at almost every turn had chances to escape his or her conviction and the consequences of their actions. In 2003 legislative session, my husband and I brought about a package of four bills. We managed to pass two of them, Senate Bill 421, which raised the penalty for criminal negligent homicide while under the influence, and also House Bill 2900, a fine for refusal of breathalyzer. We also worked on two other bills, that we saw as critical tools for reducing the number of DUI homicides and serious injuries on Oregon roadways, which is approximately 200 deaths, 2,000 injuries, year in and year out. Senate Bill 302, the diversion agreement, was one of the other bills that we worked on. But Representative Barker's bill, House Bill 2885, the three strikes bill, lifetime revocation for DUI, for three DUIs, was the other. We were honored to be part of the process in passing this bill. We were pleased and we felt we had made progress in the war against drunk driving. It was a good session for DUI bills and for Oregonians as well. I received quite a lot of feedback from those who work within the system. Sorry. I have two reasons for wanting to pass 3163. Muni courts are often destroying the necessary documents for the conviction of felony DUI and the three strikes lifetime revocation at 10 years or less. I met with a court administrator from a muni court to confirm what I had heard. I wanted to hear it from them. They said they kept some documents, destroyed the rest, placed it on microfilm at some point, and at the end of 10 years, destroyed the microfilm. I asked, what if the circuit court needs those records? DMV would have them. I said, well, the circuit court needs the actual documents when prosecuting felony DUI and the three strikes law. The reply was it was too expensive, and I thought about the $108,000 for each serious DUI injury and the $3.6 million for each DUI fatality. And when I expressed that, they said they were doing what was required. My second issue is there are muni courts who are doing a good job with hardworking judges and prosecutors who are dedicating themselves to getting the drunk driver off the road. I know some of them, and I have great respect for them. There are some in my county who dedicate their time, valuable time, and services to the victim impact panel. But the law is not being followed in all muni courts. I have received quite a bit of feedback from those who work within the system regarding the DUI offender all over the state. Here are some of the comments from the alcohol and drug evaluators. Excuse me. A, since the law was passed that 3 UI DUIs and you're revoked for life, the judges don't convict on 2 of them when an offender comes in front of them. The judges collapse them into 1. Another trick is to keep the first diversion and convict on a second arrest. We have offenders coming to our office with both quite frequently. B, I'm just getting ready to see an offender who has had 4 DUIs, 89, 91, 04, and 07. He was given a 1-year probation. C, conviction suspensions are backdated to the date of offense, not to the date of conviction. I think this is not only incredibly irresponsible, it's against the law. We are talking about the high-risk offender here, the repeat offender. These repeat offenders pose a significant threat to public safety. MAD defines them with 2 or more drunk driving offenses. A third of those arrested are repeat offenders, and many of those are with a .15 BAC or above. And those with a .15 or above are 380 times more likely to be involved in a fatal crash than a sober driver. The current tragedy is that of the Eugene Symphony members this last February. I would like to see all muni courts become court of record on DUI cases and held to the same standard as circuit courts, not just those with populations of 25,000. But I believe this is a step in the right direction. Let's stop enabling these hardcore drinking drivers. I would like you to please move House Bill 3163 forward, and I appreciate this time to testify. I would be happy to answer questions, but I have also asked Josh Marquis to be here. And if you have technical legal questions, I would like to defer them to him, please.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Pratt? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mrs. Pratt, and thanks for bringing this. I think we've been pretty good and successful so far with our DUII. Question I think I have is, we've established a population of 25,000 or less may opt out. Is that what we're saying here, Minister Crane?
No, it's the bill would only apply to those that are smaller than 25,000. Cities that are larger than 25,000 could still operate their municipal courts even if they are not courts of record.
Do we know how many courts this affects, Mrs. Brett?
No, I do not. Perhaps Mr. Marquis would be able to answer that better than I could.
Yeah, why don't we... If there are no questions of Mrs. Pratt based on her personal history with this issue, which is a compelling story itself, as we've heard on some other occasions, maybe what we ought to do is hear from Mr. Myers on behalf of the Ministerial Judges and then from Mr. Marquis. Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Pratt.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Carl Myers.
Excuse me. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, for your record, I'm Carl Myers. I'm the president of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association, and I'm reluctantly here to pass on to you the association's opposition to this bill and to try to give you several reasons why. Most importantly, we're not sure this bill is necessary. We're not sure there is a problem. Certainly there is a problem with drunk driving, and the judges across the state that handle these, I think, are acutely aware of that. But we're not sure that there is a significant problem with record keeping. There may be in some jurisdictions, but it is not a universal problem that needs a universal fix, statewide law. I submit to you that if this were a universal problem, we'd have all the DAs here and probably circuit court judges and some others here to testify. But it is not a statewide problem. Apparently, there are courts that are doing it correctly, and those judges, those convictions are withstanding collateral attack, and the and the drunk drivers are getting whatever they deserve under the law. But the proponents give you no statistics as to how many cases are thrown out, how many bad cases there are, or what the statistical data would be to justify applying this across the state. If record keeping were an issue, I would submit to you that we would see justice courts as part of this, because justice courts are also not courts of record, and they often handle populations far less than 25,000 in their justice court. You should ask these questions before you vote. How many cases a year do we have that this bill would apply to? Why 25,000 population? Why not 40,000 or so? If it is a record-keeping issue, I would suggest to you that it is pretty it ought to be a problem throughout the system. Ironically, we have a number of judges, myself included, who have two courts. One court is in a city of a population of greater than 25,000, and I handle another court that has probably less than 700 people in its municipal jurisdiction. Apparently, I can handle those cases in the big court correctly, but I cannot handle those same cases in the small court correctly because of the 25,000, the difference in population. So I submit to you, you should ask yourself that, and why only, again, why only municipal courts are part of this? Why not justice courts? Again, we have a number of judges who preside in justice courts and who also preside in muni courts. Now, I don't know why, quite honestly, why the League of Oregon Cities isn't here. They would be a wonderful resource for you as to why small cities handle these kinds of cases. I cannot answer that from their point of view. But I do know from talking to judges that they handle DUII cases in small jurisdictions for a number of reasons, most importantly because it's a local issue and they want to deal with it locally. Other small cities are located very far away from the county seat, and to ship these cases off to a county seat of, say, 75, 100 miles away, or in eastern Oregon even further than that, they lose officers' time in their jurisdiction, in their city, when they're off driving a long ways to a county seat for a hearing or a trial or whatever. But there, I'm sure there are other reasons that the cities handle these. And I will tell you that the very population that this bill is, the very class of courts that this bill is intended to control, the group of less than 25,000, are the very cities that cannot become courts of record because of the expense, and because in many cases there is not a lawyer available in that jurisdiction to handle these, to serve as judges. The question was asked last Friday about how many of the municipal court judges are non-lawyers. I would suspect it's about 50%, and we have somewhere around 100 municipal court judges. Now, many of those judges handle two or three or more jurisdictions, and again, some of them handle not only municipal courts but justice courts as well. I don't know what the problem is on collateral attack. To the best of my knowledge, there has only been one court case, and I may be wrong, that dealt with the underlying conviction and got to the Court of Appeals. And interestingly enough, that, in my understanding, dealt with a justice court and not a municipal court. So if there is a problem, it's up and down the system. It may even be a problem in circuit courts. I do not know to whom the prior witness spoke. But court administrators across the municipal court administrators across the state try to do things right and are doing things right as far as I know. We try to educate our judges and our court clerks as to how to handle them right, and I would submit to you, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, if this were a problem, the first step ought to be that the district attorneys in the various jurisdictions go to their local courts and tell them how to handle it correctly, what records need to be kept, or you as a body could come up with a statute that says these are the requirements for a conviction on DUII, here's how long you keep the records, here's the form in which you keep the records, instead of doing taking away the city's ability to handle these cases. Statistically, I've only heard from one jurisdiction, Linn County, And Linn County's municipal courts that handle DUIIs are all less than 25,000, and they all have they all do DUIIs, and the amount of cases last year, their statistical average is about 86 cases per year that they send, that they handle at the local level. With, if this bill passed, that would be handed on to Linn County Circuit Court. Quite a financial impact, I might add, to the Circuit Court. I do not know what the statistics are from others, but I know Wayne County has, I think, four jurisdictions, municipal courts, Florence, Oak Ridge, Cottage Grove, and Springfield, I believe, that all handle DUIIs, and with the exception of Springfield, they're located a significant different distance from the county seat of Eugene, and it would be very hard on them to have their officers go to circuit court to process all these cases. So I would submit to you that there are other ways that this could be handled without taking a big sledgehammer to a fly. I am not trying to undermine the importance of DUII convictions. But if this is a problem of record keeping, that can be handled very easily with just some education and some instruction from you or the DA, the district attorneys. I know in my own county, Marion County, that if our court was doing something wrong, the Marion County DA or one of the deputies would be in our court helping us get it right, because we're all in this together. The courts are, if there is a problem with our record keeping, we can do that. And apparently a significant portion of the cities are doing that at this point. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. In this regard, we just don't think this bill is necessary at this time. Let's try a more local approach before we hammer some of the cities that are doing it correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Any questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Myers, or is it Judge Myers?
Well, I'm not in court today, so it's Mr. Myers.
Mr. Myers. Thank you. And I'd like to focus a little bit on the difference between record-keeping and courts of record, because it's my understanding that the purpose of the bill is to make sure that there's some record of a prior conviction for further on down the road, and I think we all agree that there's a problem with driving under the influence, and we want to do what we can to make sure that those cases are prosecuted fully. But I'd like to focus a little bit on what governs record keeping now. I understand that there's more of a structure for courts of record, that the whole procedure has to be recorded. But what governs right now the records that courts have to keep that aren't courts of record?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I am not sure. Perhaps the best person to answer that would be a court administrator or somebody from the state court system. I believe that it is the records are kept pursuant to whatever statutes are out there. I don't know if there is a time period for keeping those records. The cities in which I deal with keep records forever. I don't know if they're transferred to microfiche at some point. Courts of record, every part of the proceeding is recorded. They need to have an additional person in the courtroom to run a tape player. If they do not have a stenographer, and in most cases they do not have a stenographer, they need to keep those tapes, and they need to be able, in some cases, to be able to transpose those tapes to writing at some point if they're needed. But beyond that, I do not know, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Judge Myers, I was wondering, you alluded to the fact that you thought that we currently only have about 50% of our judges that are members of the state bar. Because my question is, can you get us the actual figures if your organization has those?
Chair McPherson, Representative Comp, I'm not sure that I can get you the actual figures, because our organization is not mandatory. So not every judge in the state belongs, not every judge belongs to our organization, nor do we necessarily keep records as to who is a lawyer and who is not. Showing of hands at our conferences indicate about 50% are and 50% are not, and it varies from time to time. My predecessor in the city of Jefferson was a non-lawyer. The city decided for a number of reasons they wanted a lawyer this time, but in many cases a jurisdiction will look for a lawyer and not be able to find a lawyer in the immediate area to handle their court because either there are no lawyers in the immediate vicinity or the lawyers in the immediate vicinity are too busy to take over the court or may have conflicts with the court because they do defense work in that court and continue that way. So many of the jurisdictions are forced in many cases to get lay judges to handle them to be able to maintain their court. And Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, if I may respond, there is an insinuation that lay judges are not as competent as lawyer judges, and I think even though I am a lawyer, I should resent that implication. Most of the judges across the state, lay or lawyer, are very hardworking, dedicated jurists. And Mr. Marquis made a comment on Friday that the quality of judges in municipal court ranges from horrible to excellent. And I would disagree with the horrible part, and maybe I should also disagree with the excellent part of that, but I would submit to you that that's true of circuit judges as well. It's true of JP judges. It depends on a judge's willingness to work, to learn, and to put in the time to be a good jurist, and it doesn't necessarily depend on their legal background.
Thank you. Chair McPherson, this is more of a question for maybe staff and for us as a committee, because when we do take action to implement a bill and pass it into a law, there are consequences, and I would like a little more information about what would be the fiscal impact to possibly for communities to get the materials this is requiring. And I don't mean to make any judgments about any judges, but since it does state that they're supposed to be members of the bar, what kind of complications would this mean for a community if we were going to enact this bill?
Well, I don't know that we have here at staff resources that could particularly answer that. What would it be the impact on municipalities? I think there was somebody from the League of Oregon Cities who was signed up on Friday.
Okay.
But I don't think that person is not back in the hearing room this morning, so it may be that we should be trying to get that kind of input.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Judge Meyer. You indicated that we should ask the question, how many cases a year would this particular bill apply to? Does the Oregon Municipal Judges Association keep any type of record or track or analysis of that type of information over a extended period of time?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, as an association, we do not. What we have to do is poll our members and to come up with statistics. I suspect that the State Court Administrator's Office may have some of those statistics because or the DMV may have some of those statistics. I could not tell you. Again, in the short period since I knew this bill was coming up to now, I was only able to get the statistics out of Linn County, and that was 86 cases. If that is 86 DUII cases that are handled at the local level, I think you could probably extrapolate from that and get a fairly good average. There may be some parts of this state where drunk driving is more prevalent than Linn County. There may be others where it's less prevalent than Linn County, but I suspect that's a pretty good average. Unfortunately, I don't know the population of Linn County to be able to extrapolate from that, but those statistics may be available someplace. We don't keep them other than if we had enough time, we could pull all our members to run those statistics at each jurisdiction. But again, not all the judges that handle municipal courts are a member of our association, and I don't know to what extent statistics are necessarily kept at the local level as to the type of case. So I don't know that. Or how readily those are available at the local level.
Thank you. Additional follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you have a record of how many members or how many municipal judges there might be in Oregon? I know you've indicated not that all municipal judges are a member of your association, but do you have some kind of information about that?
Chair McPherson and Representative Flores, I think that number is available. I do not have it with me. The treasurer of our association keeps a pretty good indication of that. Municipal courts are required to register and do so with the state court administrator's office, and I think the League of Oregon Cities has statistics on that. I'm just not aware of how many municipal courts there are out there, how many judges there are, because again, there are several of us that handle multiple jurisdictions, and again, what the breakdown is on as opposed to lay judges and lawyer trained judges. So the statistics may be there, but we don't have a handle on them. We don't have them. I don't have them readily available, and if they do, I'm not sure how reliable our statistics are at the association level.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I think that all information would also be helpful as we contemplate this issue.
Representative Barker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Myers, what do we have to do, though, to get municipal courts to be courts of record for this? I mean, it doesn't seem like if somebody's going to go to prison on their fourth one, we need to have those court records again or they won't go. And so in Multnomah County, where it's all circuit court, everybody would essentially going to prison, at least in theory, after four. But maybe if they're from some smaller county, they could just say, municipal court, not a court record, no big deal. So if it's a matter of equal justice around the state, I would think we'd need a court of record. Panel D was...
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, again, I'm not sure I agree with the premise. There are courts that are not courts of record that are apparently keeping the kinds of records that are necessary to sustain a conviction against collateral attack. Otherwise, again, we would have DAs from across the state all here saying there is a significant problem. We have one DA, and again, without statistics to that point. So I think it is possible for a non-court of record to keep the kinds of records to be able to sustain those convictions. I'm not sure. There was a second part of your question, and I've lost it.
That's essentially it. It was just, how are we going to do that?
But I think that, quite honestly, if the district attorneys would get together and come up with a checklist to submit to the local courts, here are the things we need from you. If we're going to sustain this, we would implement it. I think you'll find that the court administrators and the municipal court judges are willing to work very hard with our counterparts at the state court level to comply with the law and to make sure that justice is done in these kinds of cases. We're not if there's a problem, it's ignorance. It's not the form of the court or who's in the court. It's just that they don't know exactly what is required. We have education twice a year for municipal judges and JP judges, and to the best of my knowledge, this issue has never been presented because no one knew it was a problem. And if it is, again, if it is a problem, educate us. We'd be happy.
And just a brief follow-up on that. So if I'm the DA and I say, here's what I want you to do, but I can't make a municipal court do anything. Is that right? I mean, you're an independent judge.
No, but Chair
reasonable
McPherson,
people would be reasonable, but there's...
I submit to you, Representative Barker, that if there are some incorrigible judges or court staffs out there, they permeate the system. They're not necessarily kept to municipal courts of populations less than 25,000.
I've dealt with both, and I'll agree with you. There's not, that there's a wide range of judges both in the circuit. And
but becoming a court, if I may further respond, becoming a court of record is very expensive. The equipment needed to set up a recording system, the tape recording, audio, video, if they want to go there, or just audio, is upward $10,000 or more. And for a small city, that's a significant portion of their budget. It also requires, again, that the judge be a member of the bar. And while I don't have a problem with that requirement, that is a significant imposition to small cities. I would submit to you, I don't know, we haven't polled our members, and there's no one here from the League of Oregon Cities, but I suspect that if this bill passes, all the DUII cases from courts of less than $25,000 will be turned over to the circuit courts. The cities will not become courts of record to handle these because of the expense. Now, I don't know that that's true. I know within the last couple of years, I've gotten inquiries from a number of cities asking what it is going to take to become a court of record, and I have sent them off to the various sources of information on that, and I do not know of one inquiry where the court actually then went to become a court of record because they found out the expense was too high, and in many of these cases, they were cities of substantial size.
And if I may just
And I might add, that's anecdotal. I have no statistics to back that up. Just
and just I was watching the news last night out in my neck of the woods. A drunk driver hit a family in a new Subaru. The new Subaru's total, all four people are in jail. And I would submit that one accident's far over $10,000. Far over $10,000. And that's why, I mean, I realize the small cities have costs, and $10,000 is a lot of money. But one accident will wipe out a $10,000 on the other side of the ledger. And I don't think that is a prohibitive price. That we need to have these things on record so that people that are the habitual drunk drivers, we can get them off the road. Just my perspective, sir.
Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you. Judge Myers, one question I had, just for my own clarification. If I'm a defendant that's convicted of a DUI in a municipal court, there's no recording devices anywhere, how might I appeal errors of law or what I thought was a wrongful conviction?
Chair McPherson, counsel, the appeal in any court that is not a court of record is a de novo appeal to the circuit court. That applies not only to municipal courts, but to JP courts and Justice of the Peace courts as well. And again, Justice of the Peace courts are not included in this bill, and they have the same quote-unquote record-keeping problems. But we need to make sure we differentiate between the records that are kept by a court sufficient to overturn a collateral attack at another court and a court of record, because again, there we can keep those records at the local level, whether or not we're a court of record. A court of record just has an additional record, a verbatim record of the proceedings that helps substantiate certain aspects as to whether the defendant was advised of his rights. But again, there are cities across the state, or they're doing it correctly now, because there are collateral attacks that have been overturned at the circuit court level or whatever the trial court level might be. So, again, there are jurisdictions that are doing it right, and not all are courts of record.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, you indicated a couple of moments ago, I think, that it would take approximately $10,000 to put in place the technology, the record-keeping sound, audio technology for municipal courts. $10,000, I think we heard testimony Friday that it would be approximately $1,000.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, that is the figure that I was told to buy the equipment. That is not the figure, and I have not looked into that. So you don't necessarily need to quote me on that, but I have heard from a number of jurisdictions that that would be about the minimum to get in the tape recording machines, the various microphones around to soundproof the room or whatever needs to be done to make sure that the record could be taken. Could be captured on audio tape of some kind. That does not include the cost of personnel for running the tape recorders. In many courts, the small courts, the judge is the only one in the room during proceedings. Now, if it's a jury trial or something like that, there's others there, obviously. But you need a person to run the machine. You need storage space for all these tapes and so on and so forth. So there are a lot of attendant costs. The best thing this committee might do, if they're concerned about the cost, is inquire as to the cities who have become recently courts of record. And I don't know who they are, but apparently Mr. Marquis knows a couple of cities that have recently become courts of record. Find out how much it costs for them. But I would submit to you that most of the cities that this bill would impact would not become courts of record. It just they operate, it's a loss for them to handle DUIIs anyway because of the costs of personnel and prosecutors and jury lists and all that kind of thing, they would just say, fine, let the circuit court handle it, and you will have fiscal impact from that transfer to the circuit state court level. That's my feeling.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Myers, I've been trying to answer my own question here and found a statute that it applies to municipal court dockets and what a municipal court has to keep in its docket if it's registered under another statute. And I'm trying to figure out the registration part. Excuse me. But included in the docket is the title of the action, the date, any order, and it also says the judgment of the court, the date on which the judgment is docketed, etc. So it looks like there's a statutory procedure for municipal courts to keep a docket and a record, if you will, even though it's not a court of record. Do you have any sense of when municipal courts register and what that registration process involves?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I do not.
Thank you.
I believe that registration process was a way to make sure that the judgments were handled by Department of Revenue or liens on property. I'm not sure, but there was not all courts register, quote unquote register, my understanding. Only if they want certain access to certain collection procedures or whatnot. I'm not. I cannot respond directly to that.
Thank you.
Judge Myers, it may be helpful for me to be reminded, maybe the rest of the committee as well, just how many justice courts there are around the state and how they relate to municipal courts. Because I mean, you've drawn the distinction that this bill applies to smaller community municipal courts, but not to justice courts.
Mr. Chair, and again, I did not bring the statistics with me. Judge Lemhouse, who was here a couple weeks ago on another bill, probably has those statistics. My recollection is there are around 34, 36 justice courts. I may be wrong on that. It seems like that's too many, but Marion County has three. Only two judges, but three separate courts. Linn County has four. Deschutes County has two, possibly three, possibly four. But not every county has them. A justice court has concurrent jurisdiction over traffic matters and misdemeanors with the state courts. Often a city will be located in an area where there is a justice court. Some of the cases will go to the municipal court, particularly those cases that happen within the jurisdictional limit of the city. If they're outside the jurisdiction or the city boundaries, they'll go to the justice court. If there's not a justice court, often they'll go then to the circuit court.
Would it be a fair generalization to say that justice courts are are generally used in places where there isn't a municipality or one of sufficient size that it supports a municipal court, but to handle more local matters? I'm just trying to get a sense of when we have them and when we don't.
Chair McPherson, I would rephrase that a little bit. I think justice courts are used where there is an awful lot of unincorporated area. Where there is not a municipality that has a court or has jurisdiction, because a municipal court's jurisdiction is limited to only the violations or misdemeanors that occur within its city boundary. So, for instance, in Marion County, if you go out past, go up up the valley to towards the Staten area, shortly after you get outside of the city limits, any citations that are there go to justice court. they're not in within the city boundaries, and it is easier for the deputies, it is easier for everyone, and quite honestly quicker because of the backlog at the circuit court level to handle these matters at a justice court. Justice courts generally do not are not in areas that have a high population, such as the metro area has, really does not have but one, I think, justice court, and that's the one in Beaverton, the justice court in Beaverton, and I am told that that's there because getting in Washington County from East Washington County to Hillsborough takes so long that it is an imposition not only to the defendants but to the police officers to make that trip, and so they have kept the justice court in Beaverton to expedite the handling of those matters and convenient for the people cited.
And approximately how many municipal courts are there on
state? I would say about 100, but that could vary. If this committee would like that statistics, if you give me a couple of days, I might be able to pull our members and get a better reading on that. I could also get a definitive number of justice courts and where they are, if that would be helpful.
And of the roughly, say, 100 municipal courts, how many of those would be in municipalities smaller than 25,000?
Probably all but about 10. Not all cities of size have, like the city of Portland does not have a municipal court per se. Not all big cities. Tualatin currently does not have a municipal court, I know. But most of them, and so, yeah, I would say probably maybe only 10 that would be above that. I may be wrong.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Judge Myers.
Thank you.
Okay. Josh Marquis has returned and expressed a willingness to come and answer questions, so I think we'd like to have him respond to some
members of the committee. If I can first please respond to a couple of the things Mr. Myers said. The DAs aren't here because I am. I'm representing the DAs Association, and we took sample of our district attorneys. There are a couple of the DAs that are not in favor of this bill. Most are. I would also tell you the vast majority of deputy DAs, the ones who try the cases, are very much in favor of this. And the reason, I think Representative Bonamici asked a good question about records, the reason we don't know any records is there are no records kept, and there's nothing requiring that records be kept. That docket is simply just that, just a docket. And what we have seen here, let's take the veil off. The real reason the muni courts and justice courts are created for the most part is to make money. Muni courts make money off infractions, not DUII cases. And justice courts have been created in places like Springfield and Bend, not because they have to drive a long way, but because the county wants to get in on some of that infraction money. So a lot of this is driven by money. The difference about this bill is this bill's not about money. This bill is about one of the most serious, or probably the most serious misdemeanor we've got, and a problem that we're getting all over the state where cases are not, the integrity of the convictions cannot be relied upon. Just to read you very briefly, here's an email from a deputy DA in Clackamas County saying, I've perceived this as a big-time problem. 2 to 3 times a year I have to forego filing a felony DUII indictment because I am unable to establish sufficient colloquy due to no record from a muni court or similar problem. Another email from Benton County saying that the problem is that in felony DUIIs there's no discussion about risk of self-representation. Another one from somebody in the Attorney General's office saying that in Washington County there were several times I could not track down a prior because they'd been destroyed or the records were too sparse. And to answer the question about why this court and not justice courts, there's a matter of accountability. Justices of the peace are elected by the people. Muni court judges are appointed by the city council. They're responsible to nobody. And if a municipal court judge were to commit an ethical violation, they're not subject to the canons of judicial conduct either. So it's a matter of accountability. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Bonamici, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Markey, is there an intermediate step that could address this concern? Could there be record keeping that doesn't go as far as establishing courts of record that would preserve the fact that a conviction had been entered?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bonamici, Yes and no. The problem is, to be blunt, is not just record keeping. It's also, in some cases, the conduct of municipal courts. The previous witness said, well, what, if there's a DA's have a problem, why don't they just go? I'll be very specific. In my county, the local daily newspaper has done a series of stories about the municipal court and about the fact that they don't follow the law. So it's not just record keeping. But to address your question about record keeping, if you could develop a statute which all the muni courts would have to follow and submit to the state court administrator's office, but that's precisely what a court of record really is, and that's all it really is saying that you have to follow the same rules as everybody else, and you've got to keep a record of this because it's such a serious matter. So I suppose, to answer your question, you could promulgate a law that said any municipal court must use the following form and then presumably must answer to somebody, because they're not answerable to anybody now except the city councils.
Thank you.
Mr. Marquis, the bill is limited to the smaller municipal courts. But although that appears to be most of the municipal courts in the state, according to what we just heard from Judge Myers. And I recall you mentioning in your presentation on Friday that that was maybe more practical and political than it was maybe a distinction, because it would seem as though if there's a reason for having a court of record handle DUIs, that it would be true for all courts. That would be true for justice courts. That would be true for municipal courts of any size. What's your thought on that?
Chair McPherson, you're absolutely right. I mean, as a policy concept, it should apply to everyone. The practical matter is that for two reasons. One, that our district attorney's offices are so underfunded that if, for example, in the city of Salem, my understanding is that if the Salem Uni Court were to shut down, which I have a hard time believing that they would just not spend the $2,000 to $3,000 on the equipment and just say, here, Walt Beglow, Marion County DA, here's 640 DUIIs. That would create, with all the problems that are inherent in DA funding, a huge problem. The other reason is, frankly, when I polled the district attorneys, the larger courts that are operated, like Salem and Eugene and Springfield, appear to have fewer of those problems because they tend to be operated more professionally. They actually have the staff.
When you say those problems, are you referring to, you think, not following the law? Are you talking about, do they not have the equipment? Are they not creating a record?
That the records that they're creating are inadequate, or the copies of the records are kept no more than 10 years, or in some cases less than 10 years. And as Ms. Pratt said, the bill that this legislature passed, I guess a session or two ago, about third strike and the fact that it's a felony DUII, raised this far beyond the usual VBR and basically parking ticket things that many courts primarily do and that are generally intended for sort of minor local offenses that can be dealt with locally.
I think it may be helpful for the committee to understand that we use the term record, I think, in a couple of different ways here. One issue is the record keeping on what the convictions have been for any one offender. But the core substance of this bill is to require that there be a recorded audio tape made of the proceeding such that it could be transcribed and then set up for if there were an appeal taken. Am I drawing the right distinction here?
Chair McPherson, yes. I mean, one of the questions asked was what would happen on an appeal. Well, one of the real costs of the current system is if you're convicted of DUII and you don't like the answer, you just get a brand new trial. You start all over again. In St. Helens, the prosecutor told me she'd try the case in St. Helens Uni Court, and the defendant would walk across the street and try the entire case, double the cost, absolutely nothing, except in that second case, when it was in circuit court, there would be a record. And therefore, what happened, it is the legal equivalent, Mr. Chairman, of sort of if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, doesn't make a sound. And legally, if a DUII falls in the forest and there's no one to hear it, it never happened.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Marquis, I'm coming back to this 25,000 city or population, and I heard you mention the city of Salem tries 640 DUII cases, but yet they're not an official court of record. Is that accurate?
That's my understanding, and I only know that because the city prosecutor wrote me a nasty email when this bill first came out expressing distress about this bill.
follow-up, if I may?
Go ahead.
So what are they doing that a city below 25,000 is not doing that allows them to be exempted out of this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, there's nothing. There's no difference between what they're doing and the 25,000, as I indicated, is a purely practical, purely political line that was drawn because of the concern, although I really don't believe that muni courts that thought they were doing a good thing, I don't think it would cost $10,000. I think it would cost about $2,000, would all of a sudden say, you know what? We give up. We're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to spend a dime on this equipment. We're going to send all those cases over to Salem. So what my informed guess would be that if you pass this bill, that those places would spend $1,000 or $2,000, get a tape recorder with four microphones, and they would be able to become courts of record.
Any further questions? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, the Chief Justice has a special courts advisory committee, and this may be a good place to refer this and see if we can get some input and action. And on the advisory committee are representatives from Justice of the Peace, municipal courts, circuit courts, and the Supreme Court. So it's group that could then maybe address records keeping versus courts of record, expenses of the courts of record, integrated record system, and things like that. Because I think we all want to do this. We all want to support what we passed. Now we passed a bill, and the courts have to respond. But there's, as we've heard today, there's a lot of issues. And also, these courts are there for the people, and that's why in rural eastern Oregon it's a problem. And I think, from my point of view, there may not be a lawyer that wants to spend his time being justice of the peace or being a municipal court judge. So I think we want to find some way to capture the record so we can keep these people off our roads. But it may need some more work, and that may be a place to do it is refer it to the special advisory committee that comes under the Chief Justice.
Any further questions or comments, committee?
I think Representative Wisnett raises a good point. There's more information we need especially with the tree analogy. If somebody's convicted of driving under the influence in a municipal court, I won't use the word record, but there has to be some proof or piece of paper or evidence or something that happened. And whether we can get that preserved some way without going the full step of court of record and serve the need, I'd like to look more into that.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Flores.
One final thought. I think that what I heard, especially from Mrs. Pratt, is that there might be a concern with the convictions not being addressed after 3 and a lifetime suspension in order to avoid that step. And so I'm concerned that if that is an issue, it needs some serious address.
Okay. If there are no further questions or comments, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3163. And as I indicated at the beginning, we're going to jump ahead in the agenda to the other public hearing, which is on House Bill 2822. Open a public hearing on 2822. Kalmanson, welcome. And I'll give us some little background on this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2822, I'll first explain the bill, and there's also dash ones to this bill. The bill establishes that a presiding officer at a contested case hearing brought under the Administrative Procedures Act must conduct a full and fair inquiry into the facts and legal issues that are relevant to a correct determination of the case and to, quote, inquire into and explore all facts and legal issues relevant to the case, end quote, whether favorable or unfavorable to the parties. The bill requires an administrative law judge to develop the record in a contested case proceeding in the same manner. And it requires a reviewing court to remand an order for further agency action if the court finds that the presiding officer failed to comply with the above requirements. The dash ones to 2822 deletes the quoted language and instead establishes that a presiding officer in a contested case hearing must ensure that the record developed at a hearing shows a, and this would be the new language, quote, full and fair inquiry into the facts necessary for consideration of all issues properly before the officer and the correct application of the law to those facts, close quote.
Well, thank you, counsel. We have Karen Berkowitz here. Ms. Berkowitz, tell us more about this bill.
Representative Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Karen Berkowitz. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center in Portland, Oregon. House Bill 2822 is a complementary bill to House Bill 2423, which is a bill that you heard on March 20th. Both bills deal with fully and fairly developing the record as to the law and the facts in an administrative hearing. What this bill does that's a little bit different is it extends that duty to contested case hearings that are conducted by the Office of Administrative Hearings. It also adds an explanation to the standard of review for the Court of Appeals to clarify that the failure to meet this duty to fully and fairly develop the record, it could be a material error in the procedure that would warrant a remand of the order. The reason why this bill is something that we were interested in initially is because after the Office of Administrative Hearings was created as a separate independent hearing officer panel, we started hearing at continuing legal education presentations that there was some question about whether the administrative law judge still had this duty to fairly develop the record and fully develop the record, since with the Office of Administrative Hearings, it's an independent group, it's not part of the agency. And, of course, we believe that the duty applies to any APA hearing, but we definitely, at this point, want to clarify that it applies to OAH hearings as well and clarify that the remedy is a remand if the ALJ fails in that duty. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Berkowitz. I guess my sort of overriding question here is this bill really necessary? Wouldn't this already be the law? That, is there some evidence that the administrative hearings officers haven't been conducting hearings in this way?
Chair McPherson,
thank you.
As I said, we always thought that ORS 183.415 applied across the board, but we did start hearing from judges from the Court of Appeals that might not be the case, which caused some concern. And then we've also run into situations where clients go in unrepresented to hearings and the ALJ misses an important issue in the case. Legal Aid or Oregon Law Center may end up getting the case on appeal, and then the case ends up being dismissed because the record hasn't been properly developed. There's been no preservation of error. So we see this as a way to, I guess, more thoroughly protect pro se clients who go into these hearings, as well as protecting represented clients.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Berkowitz? If not, then why don't you stay there at the witness table, Ms. Berkowitz. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2822 and open a work session on House Bill 2822. Committee, this is not a very dramatic bill in my view. In fact, I'm not sure it should be necessary, but there it is. There's some indication formal statement in the statute that hearings should conduct a full and fair inquiry into the facts and legal issues, and that if there's a record to be developed that establishes that, and if not done, then there's an opportunity for a remand, further proceedings. That certainly seems like the way an administrative system ought to work. and we have uncontested testimony before us that says that this is necessary to clarify the law. There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this bill, so it's not a last handling of it, so that will be somebody looks at from a fiscal standpoint after it makes the stop with us. Represented by Meacham.
Why is there a referral to Ways and Means?
Counsel, I'm not sure that I can say why that is.
My guess is someone who looked at this quickly thought that maybe this was inquiring more of ALJs, but that's a good question.
It seems that if the intent is to just make sure that there's something on the record about how they're applying a lot of the facts, and I can't see that that's for ALJs.
Right. We could. I think it was within our authority to pass it out, do pass, and then make a request of the Speaker's office to rescind the prior referral. It does seem as though there would be no basis for that referral.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. Would Mrs. Berkovic comment on...
Yeah, Ms. Berkowitz, do you have any thoughts on that Ways and Means referral?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, I don't have a clue why that happened. I certainly don't see that.
Mr. Chair, if we're speaking about the bill in its present form, right, are these hearing officers attorneys? The question would be.
I don't think they are.
So if I may follow up, I mean, there may be, if they have to have an inquiry into, quote, legal issues, is there an involvement with more professionals that would interpret those, quote, legal issues that potentially?
If the course of least resistance for us may be to pass it out on because we're a policy committee, and then if Ways and Means that concludes after discussion they say fiscal that it doesn't have an impact, then they can just pass it through summarily.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Flores.
I understand the rationale, but I am a little bit concerned because oftentimes if something wants to die, it will go to Ways and Means to do so. And I don't necessarily want to see this particular bill die because I think there is concern in the administrative procedures portion of our statute, and this is trying to address that. So if there isn't a significant Ways and Means impact, I'd like that to be determined before we just send it off to languish.
But council suggests, and this may be a good suggestion, that we not move the bill today, but to see what we can do to determine why it had that subsequent referral and see whether people are comfortable with it being lifted and then bring it back to move it after that.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that it's not going to require any additional qualifications for administrative law judges, but rather to require that they build a record. They still have to know how to apply the law to the facts. They are lawyers. That's what they do in their job.
And, Mr. Chair, I would say that I've had some constituent issues in the past where they've rested squarely on this issue. And so I'm supportive of the bill and don't want to see it get lost.
Okay. Quite well taken. Well, if that's a comfortable approach to the committee, then I don't see anybody racing forward for motions. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2822. And open a work session on House Bill 2507. Council Collins. Do you have any more on today's? Okay, so you stand by. We'll stand at ease for a moment while Council Taylor is summoned. remind us what was happening with
sure.
this bill.
Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2507 comes to you from on the Committee on the Judiciary. Many remember that Representative Richardson testified on behalf of the bill back in February. Disqualifies a person arrested for charged with murder from determining how the remains of the deceased should be handled, established this decision should be made by the first eligible person on the list in ORS 9730, subsection 2. You have the dash 1 amendments in front of you, which go over to page 3 and delete the term aggravated murder because it's basically subsumed within the term criminal homicide. And then you have the dash 2 amendments in front of you that came from Warren Darris, which basically, when you go to page 1 on the list, it put at the top of the list a person to whom the decedent has granted the power of attorney. So they would be the first person that would make the choice as to where the remains, how the remains should be taken care of. You may remember that Representative Richardson testified that there was a problem in, I believe, in Bend or one of the counties east of the mountains, and it's been a problem in the past, too, where a spouse, for example, is charged with murdering the other spouse and then starts playing hardball on the issue of how and when the murdered spouse should be buried. And under the statute, they are the first person on the list.
I remember the discussion of the bill and the discussion about the fact that aggravated murder was kind of an extraneous reference.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't recall is any discussion in our prior hearing about the point that is covered by the dash twos, that is putting a person to whom the decedent has granted power of attorney first in line.
Okay.
And I assume that Mr. Darris, I don't see him in the room here today. It seems logical enough to me to do that, but it just is something I don't remember hearing any input before and on that point.
I think Mr. Darris was in the audience that day on another bill. And Warren Darris is an attorney from Portland. Chair members of the committee, Warren Monamici. He's an attorney from Portland that oftentimes is down here on behalf of the bar on their estate planning section, the elderly law section issues. He practices in the area of estates and trusts.
I guess the only concern I would have with the dash twos is that there may be circumstances in which a person would give a power of attorney to someone who is not in sort of close relations, if mm-hmm. somebody on whom they rely for financial kinds of matters, and that wouldn't necessarily be the same person who would be most appropriate for deciding disposition of remains. I'd throw that out to the committee and see. That's just my initial reaction, is that it doesn't go to the issue that Representative Richardson had brought forward, which is that somebody who's been accused of wrongdoing in connection with the death wouldn't be the right person to be making those decisions. It goes really off in a different direction. And what may be appropriate, I can imagine that one might, if that one's attorney who might have been given a power of attorney or a financial advisor had been given a power of attorney, and that wouldn't be a person who's necessarily more appropriate than spouse, son or daughter, parent, the other people, and this would move the person who'd been granted power of attorney to the head of the line.
Mr. Chair, I have to agree with you. I don't recall in doing bazillions of powers of attorney that there have been provisions for making determinations that are usually provided in last wills and testaments for disposal of and burial arrangements and so on. So that is a rather interesting question.
So, committee, my suggestion would be that we act on the dash one amendments and not the dash twos. And it's not that I think the dash twos are necessarily faulty, but they raise a little broader issue than what we had presented to us before. I think that may be an issue for another day. Representative Bonamici?
I agree, Mr. Chair, and another concern is that the dash two amendments would amend that part of the statute without reference to the part of the statute that this bill is trying to address.
it would put the person to whom the decedent has granted power of attorney as number one in all cases, because there's no reference back to the situation that we're trying to address, which is in the very limited, which I understand is only a few cases where the spouse has been accused of murdering other spouse. And so we're changing the statute in a big way, which I don't think is a good idea.
Well, not without a little more input, I would say. I mean, it may be appropriate, but I'm uncomfortable going with that. So I would invite a motion on the dash one amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments into House Bill 2507.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2507. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Then the dash ones are in. Is there a motion on the main bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2507 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2507 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, now in not considering, on the other hand, not considering the dash twos, are we preserving the intent of this legislation, which is to disqualify a person who has committed murder, and from making the determination if, for example, the murderer has murdered a spouse, and are we disqualifying them from making the determination of disposition of a decedent's remains? Although, because they do remain at the top of the list, beginning on page 1 at line 17.
Yeah, I'd see the substance of the bill then is
page 3,
is page
starting
3,
at 7.
Yeah,
okay.
And I think that my reading of it is it wouldn't be just a spouse, although that might be the, since, for whatever reasons there's probably sociological, psychological reasons why maybe homicide by a spouse is more prevalent than homicide in those other close relationships. But it wouldn't be just a spouse. It would be just any person who is in one of those relationships and who is accused. And it's not a person who's convicted. It's arrested or charged with, so they maybe they're innocent until proven guilty. But because there has been some probable cause or something to indicate that they had some role of wrongdoing in the death, then they would be precluded from being wherever they are in order of priority.
And Mr. Chair, obviously the time wouldn't allow a conviction. I mean, those 3
right.
years.
Yes, that's right, because a conviction would take span over a long period of time. So just take them out of that position in the priority.
Thank you.
So we have a motion before us, Representative Bonamici.
I just wanted to make a comment that was brought up by yourself and Representative Barker that I'm going to support this bill, but I am a little bit concerned about the fact that it applies to somebody who's been accused and not convicted, because we have in our system of justice a presumption of innocence. But in this case, I don't see the right to dispose of the remains of somebody as such a fundamental right. But I do have concerns that we're addressing somebody who's been accused or not convicted.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yeah, Mr. Barker.
But I think what we're trying to get out here is I murdered my wife, and then I do something with her body that her family just really objects to, just to be mean. I mean,
or to destroy evidence. I understand the concern.
Well,
that's why I'm going to support it.
I would suspect evidence wouldn't hold it long enough for that. But yeah, these other things where people just do just these bizarre things people as human beings do to each other. That's what we're trying to prevent here.
Any further discussion? If not, then we have the motion before us by Representative Barker to pass House Bill 2507 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wizard.
Aye.
Chairman Person.
Aye. House Bill 2507 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'm going to ask Representative Richardson to be the carrier, and if he doesn't is not able to do that, then I'll make one a member of the committee to carry it. Close the work session of House Bill 2507 and open a work session of House Bill 2385. Council Kalmanson, remind us about House Bill 2385.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2385 was before this committee on February 13th and concerns the duties of self-insurers, which are, heard some testimony about rental car agencies have duties to insure, but there was a sort of a hole in the law that so that there, if they insured to somebody who was not didn't have their own insurance, the insurance that the self-insurer is required to provide does not cover that person. So if someone got into an accident, there was no insurance coming to them. There are dash ones that are before the committee, and the dash ones clarify that the insurance required under this bill, which would be the insurance that a self-insurer must provide to cover permissive drivers, that insurance would be secondary to any liability insurance or uninsured motorist insurance coverage that is available to either the customer of the self-insurer, an operator of the self-insured vehicle, or an occupant of the self-insured vehicle. The dash ones also established that the self-insurer is not required to insure a person who is operating the vehicle without permission of the self-insurer, and the dash one amendments also clarify a few of the statutory references.
Okay. It's been a while since this bill was before us, and so I'm sure that people are having to try to get back to speed, as certainly I had to. So the original intent of the bill, which is to extend coverage to permissive drivers and make that secondary to the permissive drivers' coverage, is still intact in the, after the proposed dash ones. Okay. Any discussion of this bill, committee?
Chair.
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you. Seems to make sense, but we had, did council, when they worked this, did they have input from the rental car and the insurance companies? Did they work with you in this and trying to?
Yeah, I believe there was a work group that was set up. There's somebody from the OLC who's here who can testify as to the makings of that, but I think there was input from all the interested parties, but you can get clarification if you want to invite Wendy Johnson up.
Yeah, Wendy, why don't you describe to us the process that brought us to the dash ones.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. This bill was before you back in February, and at that time we brought before you the insurance industry, a defense attorney, and a plaintiff's attorney, and explained to you how great this bill was and how everybody was on board, including the rental car industry, as long as these amendments are put in to clarify. And at that time, because of the legislative council drafting process, we weren't able to have the amendments ready. But the Law Commission, in its approval of this recommended bill, included those amendments, but we just weren't able to actually have them formally before you, but we had provided them in the report what we wanted to be amended.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
On the, this is a fix of the committee amendments, it says establishes that self-insurer is not required to insure a person who is operating a vehicle without permission of the self-insurer. So if that person was driving that car that hurt somebody, who's liable? Whose insurance is going to take care of it if that self-insurer isn't required to insure that person who's illegally driving that vehicle? In other words, it could be a stolen vehicle.
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, the way the bill provides, it does allow now for uninsured, your uninsured and underinsured policy to kick in, and that was another hole, that if you got hit by a self-insured car, you had no recourse, and this bill does correct that problem as well. So you can go to your own insurance policy. And my understanding is the self-insurer would also have to have uninsured, underinsured policy as well.
I guess. Okay. School for spies who are spying on spies.
Representative Whitman.
Yes, the question, if we all go to rent our car and we say we'll use our own insurance, are we okay?
Yeah, you're okay.
I want to probe the lines 8 to 10 of the dash ones. If I rent a car, so I'm a from a rental car company that is self-insured, and so I'm a permissive driver. But if I lend that car to somebody who is who's not approved or permitted by the rental car company, then this bill would not require that self-insured rental car company to cover any consequences of that non-permissive users operating the vehicle. Is that right?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, that's my understanding, and I believe that's how generally regular policies work, is non-permissive users.
The question I would ask is that any different from what would happen if that rental car company were not self-insured, if it were a small enough organization or that they had an insurance policy, and I was a permissive user under that insurance policy, and I lent the car to somebody else who's not permitted by the insured to use it, and they have an accident, would it be the same result? Because I think what we're trying to do is to put the results the same for a self-insured arrangement as they would be under an insured arrangement.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, that's my understanding. I think there's a difference between liability and insurance coverage, and so I think that's also what this is clarifying.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, just briefly.
Mr. Krieger.
Got the insured car. I've rented it. My son, who's a legal driver, uses it and hits somebody. The person who got hit is injured. Who pays for that injury?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, I think it would depend on what policies your son had in terms of which kicks in first.
What if he has no insurance and he just has a driver's license, doesn't own a car?
Then he would be, Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, he would be an uninsured driver, and the injured party may have claims both against the self-insurer but also under their own uninsured policy. He's a non-permissive user, and so I think the policy argument is that your son isn't supposed to be driving if he doesn't sign the rental agreement, so he's an uninsured, non-permissive user.
That sounds right, except I think you were suggesting that maybe there would be a claim against the self-insured rental car company, and I think that's not the case under this bill.
Chair McPherson, I think that's right, but there also is a requirement to have an uninsured, underinsured, uninsured policy for the self, or coverage for the self-insured, and so I'm not positive how all that works.
She lost me.
My understanding of how this bill works is that the self-insurer is not required to provide the liability coverage to non-permissive drivers. So if Representative Krieger's son is a non-permissive driver and crashes into somebody, the self-insurer would not be liable, and it would be the son who would be originally liable. If he doesn't have insurance, then the injured party's uninsured motorist coverage would kick in and cover it then. That's my understanding of how this is supposed to work. If there's sort of other quirks of insurance laws that I'm just not aware of, but that's how I think it's.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
And I think clarification on the permissive, non-permissive is helpful at this point. And then Representative Krieger's example, his son, who would be driving a car that Representative Krieger had rented, would be a non-permissive driver by virtue of the fact that Wayne Krieger's name was the only signature on the rental agreement, not the son's. Was that the case in your example? So, as Ms. Johnson, Wendy has said, he would be a non-permissive driver. And I think we kind of went around that loop when we first heard this bill because it's sounding vaguely familiar. But uninsured, underinsured, permissive, and non-permissive, I think, are kind of the balls that we're trying to juggle here and evaluate.
I think the policy question to me raised by this aspect of the dash ones is if I say it's not a rental car situation, it's just I have a regular liability policy for my automobile, and I permit my adult child to drive it, and that adult child then allows somebody else to drive it who's not insured, has no insurance, and they cause injury to someone else, would my insurer have to pay so that they would be, my insurer would be in a more on the hook than this bill would put the self-insured rental car company?
Chair McPherson, I think I figured out the answer here. Generally, the insurance coverage follows the car. With self-insurance, it's an exception, and so it doesn't. But this bill is making sure that there is some coverage for self-insurers when the person who's driving the car really doesn't have insurance. And so right now there's a gap in the law because we've made a policy choice that we don't want self-insurers to always have this burden that people are signing that they have insurance, and so we're flipping that generally for self-insurers. But in your case of a son or daughter and then another person using the car, they would be considered permissive as long as it wasn't a stolen car or something that truly was out of permission. But generally, the coverage covers or follows the car. But I think we heard testimony at the last hearing that that's an exception to self-insurers, and that's why it's a little it's tricky to walk through this amendment. But that's what's going on, is it's a policy difference.
Okay. I have a question. I don't know if you can answer this. As far as a permissive driver, I sign up and they say you can't take the car out of order. If I'm in California, am I a non-permissive driver at that point? Do you know? That's probably an individual contract question, really.
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, yes, I'm not sure how that exactly would work.
Okay, committee, we have one more work session we need to get to here yet today. I would say if we move this bill today with the dash one amendments, at least in my mind, it will be more in reliance on this being a consensus product and coming to us from the Oregon Law Commission, which is an organization that has demonstrated its high capability in dealing with technical issues, more than, I would have to say, my complete understanding of the subject matter.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think there are a couple of Oregon Law Commission bills that we have some fractured discussion on, so we'll rely on that assertion.
I would see whether other people feel that same comfort based on who is bringing it forward to us, or whether people would rather try to penetrate this the policy choices in this bill further.
Mr. Chair, I think they added something that clarified something to help uninsured motorists or to be sure somebody, there's some claim available there. They can't do everything. Obviously, they can't. We can't expect a rental company to cover everybody that I may give them the car to. I mean, there's some responsibility on the renter. And I think, and especially as you say, coming from the Oregon Law Commission, their credibility is pretty high with us. And I would, if I may, I would go ahead and make a motion.
Very good.
I'll move the dash ones into House Bill 2385.
Representative Barker moves the dash ones into House Bill 2385. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, the dash ones are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2385 is amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves the House Bill 2385 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll give you my complimentary or courtesy vote as long as I don't have to carry it. And if I don't hear anything from the two parties, the conflict, what we've learned.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
And
thank you. I do notice on the staff measure summary, once again, it does indicate there may have a fiscal impact. Do we have any idea of what that might be or why?
Thank you, Representative Flores. It's only because there's a dash one amendments, they just haven't issued it yet. So but I think on the original bill, there was no fiscal impact. But whenever the amendments come out, we have to send it back down to get another fiscal. So. But I wouldn't. There's no subsequent referral, and I wouldn't expect there to be a fiscal on this.
Representative Krieger.
I'll just say pretty much what Representative Whitman said. see if anything comes between now and the time it hits the floor, and if not, then we'll go in.
And certainly, committee, if something did surface at that point, I would certainly be amenable to bringing it back into committee to work it some more. So we have the motion to move House Bill 2385 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonnie
G.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Walker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnick.
Aye.
Chairman Perkins.
Aye. House Bill 2385 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And we need a carrier. We already have a couple of people who have taken a step back.
I haven't carried many.
Representative Comp, bless you.
I have a question of a carrier. Lots of them.
Lost your mind?
Okay, we have finally on I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2536. Council, remind us about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2536, what we call in the office the booster seat bill, concerned the requirement that a passenger who is under 13 years old sit in the rear seat if one is available. There were a few other requirements in there dealing with requiring passengers who were under, I think it was 4 feet 9 inches. But there was a requirement based on height to sit in a booster seat. There were some concerns raised at the hearing about some anecdotal evidence of situations where there was somebody who was under 13, but it was more practical for them to sit in the front seat than the maybe a grandmother or something. So before the committee are dash ones and dash two amendments, both of which amend the requirement dealing with the 13-year-old having to sit in the rear seat, and they're just different variations on that requirement. The dash one amendments provide that a 13-year-old passenger must sit in the back seat if it is equipped with a safety belt, unless it is, quote, not practical to operate a motor vehicle with a passenger who is under 13 years of age in a rear passenger seating position. The dash two amendments provide that a 13-year-old passenger must sit in the back seat if the back seat is equipped with a safety belt and is not, quote, occupied by a vulnerable passenger or a passenger who is under 13 years of age. And the dash twos define vulnerable passenger to mean a passenger who is older than 13 and, by reason of medical condition or body size, is at greater risk of injury in the event of an accident than the passenger who is under 13 years of age.
Okay, and we have Jeff Merrick, who presented when we had the hearing on this originally. I'd like to invite him to offer comments on the dash one and dash two amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Merrick, and I was working with the Safe Kids Legislative Committee on this. And the difference between these two amendments are these. Dash one would give potentially a parent the option to prefer cargo over people. They might say it's more practical to put my groceries in the back seat or the new TV I bought, and that's why our committee opposes the dash one. The dash two bill basically protects what the committee chair, the committee members were talking about last time, which is what if you have somebody who's more vulnerable than my 13-year-old linebacker, and why should that person, be at more risk? And so we support the dash two amendment. We oppose the dash one amendment.
Mr. Merrick, any questions for Mr. Merrick? Okay, committee members, we have the policy choices here before us. There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this bill as well, and it's because of an interplay with federal grants or funding sources. Is that right, Council?
Right. Oregon passes this bill. There's a federal law that says if you put in a requirement, basically the booster seat requirement that's in this bill, it triggers federal grants, which have to be spent on education, dealing with passenger safety and the like. And I think there's some requirements of you have to spend the money within a certain time period, and there was some concern that means it needs to go to Ways and Means. So there's been a subsequent referral based on that issue.
Representative Wisnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The clarification is that to get the federal funding, though, is strictly the booster chair and not the 13-year-old in the front seat or back seat or wherever. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I understand, our policy options here in the dashed ones or twos, a 13-year-old still would be prohibited from sitting in the front seat. Is that correct?
For the dash ones, they would be prohibited from sitting in the front seat unless it's not practical, quote unquote, to be in the back seat. In the dash twos, they'd be prohibited from sitting in the front seat unless there's a more vulnerable passenger, quote unquote, sitting in the back seat. So in either case, there's sort of an exception that's been carved out, which gives people some discretion to allow the 13-year-old to sit in the front seat.
And actually, it's under 13 years of age.
Under 13.
So it'd be the 12-year-old. Ms. Merrick, am I reading that right? I mean, the 13-year-old.
The dash twos indicate
it's okay,
13
but,
years
but
of age.
It's the 12-year-old and under who.
Yes, it's under 13, right. Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
As I read the dash twos, person commits the offense of endangering child safety if the person operates a motor vehicle on the highways of this state with a passenger who is under 13. So if they've reached 13, they can sit in the front seat. So we're
yes.
saying 12. Mm-hmm. And then the paragraph two, by a vulnerable passenger or by a passenger who is under 13, again. And as used in this section, vulnerable passenger means a passenger 13 years of age or older who, by reason of medical condition or size, is at greater risk. So
that's as I can put my elderly mother in the back seat and move my 12-year-old in the front seat.
Or 13-year-old.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or big 13-year-old.
Yeah, 13-year-old or older, you could freely sit wherever. I mean, the policy choice reflected in the bill is that it's been proven that the safest place in a crash is in the back seat, particularly if you're of small size. And that's particularly more significant nowadays that most cars are equipped with airbags, which present certain kinds of hazards to small passengers.
And if you could you refresh me, please, how does this deal with vehicles where there are rear seat airbags?
I don't think it does. I don't think there's an exception for that type of vehicle.
So we put them on the on the hood.
Yeah, no, I think there are side curtain airbags, but I don't think there is such a. Yeah. Are there rear airbags?
Not that I know. I don't think so. It's smacking against them. It's a problem. The side air curtains just keep you from getting hit
in the rear.
The windows are on the side. Yeah, on the front as well. And I mean, my car, so I have side curtains throughout the length of the car, both front and rear. So if I got broadsided, those would deploy and, you know, hopefully prevent injury of smacking into the doors or whatever.
Yeah. Okay, you can tell I don't have a new car.
Representative Krieger.
A thought occurs to me. All your midsize and small pickups only have front seats. So then you can, that's okay to have your kid there then. But you're going to get a ticket if you got him in the front of a car that has a back seat. And it seems to me, at what point does government quit telling us what we need to be doing? I'll be a no on the bill.
Any further discussion? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I understand the booster sheet. Seat issue, we heard that before, but there's a couple issues. One, Representative Krieger, but also the deletion of if I'm up getting my Christmas tree where I shove an extra person in the back of my Suburban or whatever, now I'll be breaking the law with page 3, deletion of line 10, so I'll be a no.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I was under the impression that as we talked about this, we would consider that the recommendation for the federal funds, as it was applicable to the two earlier younger age elements, would be kind of the focus, and that we might consider not the older child. I understand all of the implications, but I guess the policy discussion crosses some fundamental philosophical lines here for me too, and I'm just kind of, I guess, surprised, number one, and disappointed, number two, that we would not focus on those requirements that would allow us to continue to receive federal funds and take that older level of child out. I know I've talked to my grandkids, and their oldest one is going to be 11 at the end of this month, and he's rather annoyed about this, not being able to sit in front seat with Papa or Nana. I'm not sure that'll be a yes, and I'm leaning toward no at this point.
Let me raise a question. There is a the language that Representative Cameron pointed out on page 3. It is an additional policy choice in addition to the booster seat element and the preference given for rear seating. And I guess the question is whether that would be, if that provision were eliminated from the bill, would that gain broader support than it has otherwise?
I'm sorry, we're going back like to the dash twos to allow.
No, actually, it would be. This is something that's not addressed in the dash ones and dash twos. On page 3, you'll see that lines 10 and 11 delete a provision that is now an exception in the law, which is that if you have all seating positions occupied, you can have additional people in the vehicle. Am I reading that correctly, Ms. Merrick?
Chair, I do not have that part in front of me. I just have the dash one and dash two amendments, so I'm not sure what you're referring to.
If all seating positions are occupied by other people.
Right, yes. No, by other persons.
That's the difference. I mean, you can't just put a bunch of stuff in the back seat and then say,
right.
Put on the front because I have this person's thing.
Right. You stuffed your Christmas tree in the back, sideways in the back seat, then that wouldn't make it permissive to have another person someplace else in the vehicle. But if you can have, in effect, my reading of the language that is in the law now and that would be deleted there on lines 10 and 11 is that if you have a 5-passenger vehicle, you could have 6 people in it or 7. As long as every seat is occupied by a person, then you could have additional people wherever, and that would not be a violation of the law.
I have that now, and that's the way I think it reads, right?
Yeah. So as I see it, this bill committee, I think, raises really three related policy choices. One is the requirement that there be booster seats, which is connected to the federal funding issue. There's the requirement that younger, smaller passengers have preferred placement in the rear seating because it's the safer place to be. And the third is this deletion, which is to not allow over capacity seating, that is more passengers than the vehicle is designed to provide seating for. I'm comfortable with all three of those policy choices myself, but I'm trying to see whether there are elements of the bill that would draw broader support if we were to move some portion thereof.
Mr. Chair, if you're asking me, I'm comfortable with the booster issue because it's a federal funding issue that's been we've been asked to change, and I'm not comfortable with the other two.
I support it as it is, Chair.
Okay.
My grandson's already weighed in on it.
Then committee, I'm going to move the dash two amendments into House Bill 2536. Is there any discussion of that motion on the dash two amendments? If not, let's have a roll call vote on that. Call the roll on moving the dash twos.
Representative
Monici.
Aye.
No.
Representative Flores.
I can support the dash twos. Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
No. Mr. Demery?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitehead?
Aye.
Chair
Aye. Dash 2 amendments are in the bill, and I'll move the House Bill 2536 to the floor with as amended. Due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion of the motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
No.
Representative Huff.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman.
Mr. Chairman, I had a problem. I thought there were three situations. I'm okay with the back seat for the 12-year-old, but about the third condition was over-occupied. So that's it.
That is in the bill as under this motion.
Can I vote no. My vote's no.
Okay.
Chairman
Person. Aye. House Bill 2536 moves with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2536, and that completes our agenda, committee. Thank you very much for your attendance. We're on the floor in a couple minutes. Okay.